Today's program is brought to you by Buyrite, a family-owned San Francisco-grown market. For more information, visit buyritemarket.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And today we have a very special slice of culinary history. And you'll find out more why I use the word slice in a minute. It's about an American institution, which was a restaurant with no waiters. Many people, probably under the age of 30, might not even know what an automat is, except if they've seen it in movies, and there are plenty of movies where the automat appears as one of the stars. The automat was one of America's beloved institutions, well, particularly in the East, Philadelphia and New York. And it really said a lot about America's eating habits, because it was a time that America started to relax their eating habits. I mean, also, I think you put it up there with schraffs in New York, working people going and catching a really quick bite to eat. The automat was the great equalizer, where one could sit at a table with wealthy businessmen or school kids or housewives or, as they said in the 40s, showbiz names. There were communal tables, which now we see in restaurants today. And all you needed was a stack of nickels. So today we're going to be talking about the automat. What is it? The history, the book, and the movie. My guest is Marianne Hardert, and my guests, the two guests, Marianne Hardert first, and Lisa Hurwitz, who we'll hear from a little later. Marianne is the great-granddaughter of one of the co-founders of the famous automat, Horn and Hardert. Horn and Hardert made a huge appearance in New York and Philadelphia, and we'll find out about that history. And Marianne is the great-granddaughter who knows a bit about the family history. And not only that, she is an actor herself and has done a lot of work with children and the healthcare systems, and also brings theater to the home, to the children and healthcare systems. But she is now an actor in her own right. And she, along with Lorraine Diehl, co-authored a book 10 years ago, well, about 12 or 15 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, 2002.
In 2002, right. About the history of the automat and some of the recipes. It was then as a celebration of the 100th anniversary. So, Marianne, welcome.
Thank you.
And tell me, you are the great-granddaughter, but the automat business stayed in your family for quite a while. Can you kind of trace a little bit of that history for me?
Yeah, sure. And thank you for inviting me to join you here today. It started with my great-grandfather and Joseph Horn, and I can go into more or less detail in that beginning as you'd like. And then
business deals.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know if I want to talk about how it affected America's eating habits,
okay.
But food.
We'll get through
no,
that.
But certainly I want to know about the business. Yeah.
And then there were really three generations of my family who stayed involved.
The Hardert family.
Yeah. Frank's sons, and then for each of them, one of their sons. So the last family member actually was my dad, who was in the business until the early 80s.
Hmm. Well, when did the first, so you go into a little bit of that business partnership with Joe Horn. Your great-grandfather was from Germany.
Yeah, and his family came over, and they were living actually in New Orleans, and he was sort of, Joe Horn actually had the restaurant background sort of in his blood already. And my great-grandfather didn't, but he was sort of an observer of people, and they connected in Philadelphia, and that was where the first restaurant opened, which was not an automat at that point. It was a little cafe, a five or seven-seater. And that was in 1888. Hmm. And the first automat didn't come about until 1902. And that was also first in Philadelphia.
So where did this concept come from?
Well, through a trip over to Germany, where you might still find not, you know, related automats, but the automat technology in use over in Europe is still going on. And so a fascination with that and a drive to sort of bring that to America and figure out a way to...
Okay, a good jumping point to explain to some of those young listeners, like our engineer, Liz, what is the technology okay. behind the automat?
Well, it certainly evolved in its bringing it from there to here. It was originally quite a contraption that was, there was nothing automatic about it, which was sort of a joke in the beginning, you know. It involved several people to get the food from one place in the restaurant to another. What it evolved into and what people who remember the restaurant from New York City and Philadelphia remember is this machine that you put in, at the time, as you mentioned, a nickel and opened a door and pulled out your meal. And it was all these glass windows so you could look and find what you wanted.
You could actually see the food before you ordered
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and I know for people who are used to these kinds of vending machines today, it doesn't seem novel, but there was nothing like that in
right.
restaurants.
Right. And well, and you say the machine, it evolved into much more than a machine. It was a whole wall
yes.
full of glass doors. I mean, as a young child, look at it, can you imagine? A whole wall full of food,
yeah.
and you could choose whatever you wanted.
Yeah, and that, you know, so many people told those stories of, you know, the freedom that they had, sometimes only there, you know, where their parents would give them some nickels and they could run and pick what they wanted. And, of course, there were people behind the windows.
The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. Right.
It didn't replenish
behind
itself.
Which, you know, has been played out in films like That Touch of Mink, and so mm-hmm. playfully plays out the role, the relationship with behind the windows. But and so fresh food was constantly being replaced. So unlike the vending machines you might find now in an office building or structure, there were people replacing the food with fresh, hot or cold food throughout the day as people ate it.
Mm. Sorry, there are no more Doritos in this.
Yeah.
No, there was a little woman behind there. And
yeah, you didn't have to call a number.
Mostly women, right?
Right.
Who would put that slice of pie.
Yeah.
was so famous. It was a nickel for a cup of coffee and a slice of pie for two nickels, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what made, in my opinion, the automats so successful was the food was really good.
Yeah, yeah.
And where was this food prepared?
Well, both cities, by the time I think I mentioned it, came to New York in 1912. So both cities had what was called a commissary, which was a central location. In New York City, it took up a whole city block where the food was prepared. And there was what was called a sample table, where every day executives sat around a table and tasted food, especially new recipes or anything anyone had ever complained about would have to go through the sample table. But so the food was centrally produced. So again, it was fresh. People would say, well, how did you, you know, the quality from one restaurant to another? Well, because it was all coming, most of it anyway, from a central place.
Yeah, well, actually, I kind of likened it in reading about the commissary and the rule books
yeah.
for the automats. I likened it to today's, you know, Hamburger University. The McDonald's has that all the franchise owners have to go to McDonald's University to learn about that quality control
yeah.
and to use the same products and make things. Although the food, we're talking about much better food here.
Right.
You know, cream pies. Oh, I remember there were cream pies.
Oh.
I do remember an automat. Not that I was someone who went and ate there, but went into the automat, took a look at it. And I do recall having one time purchased something, but then they rapidly disappeared. But
yeah, the last was in the early 90s. And but yeah, people have such strong memories and attachments to the food that they remember getting and getting every, like the macaroni and cheese and the baked beans and the Salisbury steak and the pies. And
and interesting because it is, as you say, it evokes such memories that people, I mean, the different people and you interviewed too, have very, very
poignant memories of it, whether they're little kids with a stack of nickels, you know, getting excited, or people who on a real budget who need, I mean, where else could you get a full meal for a few nickels?
And you could stay there all day, and some people didn't even get a meal. They would get the hot water, and you know, there's stories of people making soup out of ketchup and hot water, or you get one cup of tea and sort of
nurse
that all day, and that was a place that allowed that, and
so they didn't kick you out. They weren't hovering over your table, and they didn't kick you out.
And
the tables were all communal. I mean, if you not unlike a lot of delis or cafes today, if you see an open chair or two at a table, you say, "Hey, is anyone else sitting here? You know, you want to sit, and I want to sit and have my sandwich."
Right.
But this was the norm, right?
Yeah, and you know, particularly during the Depression, it was acceptable to have all kinds of different people there. And that was the fun also, was you didn't, I mean, celebrities would go, you know, business people would go, as you mentioned in the beginning, all kinds of people went. So it was a very egalitarian environment in that
It was
way.
Quick, kind of anonymous and you know, in cheap.
Quick,
cheap. Yeah. But one thing I know that kind of, intrigues me. Well, it got to be known for its coffee, the Automats, because the coffee, there's a little story behind the coffee, how they made it and changed it often and tested it constantly.
Well, and you mentioned the rule book, so there were very specific, I mean, multiple step directions on managing the coffee and changing it if it hadn't, you know, if it during low, you know, slow periods, and the same, they did that with their soups as well. I mean, they were very particular about managing the quality.
It kept the quality of the food up.
Yeah.
Well, supposedly the coffee came from these spouts that were dolphin heads.
Yes.
What's the story behind the dolphin heads?
That also, I think that may have been Joe Horn's contribution. And again, I think from a trip over to Europe, and he was inspired, but there was no attention to detail, and that's a perfect example. Like, because who would think, you know, to serve coffee? But the restaurants, that was the other thing about them, is they were beautiful, many of them.
Well, just
architecturally,
the brass, right? The brass and the glass alone, sparkling. Well, you know, that's what somebody mentioned in one of the articles, that the glass made everything appear clean.
Yeah,
and this was a time when there were some pretty suspect little food dives hanging around in the major cities, right? So everything looks sparkling and clean. I'm sure there were a lot of rules in that book about wiping them out.
And I think, especially in the earlier, when you were mentioning women coming into restaurants, the restaurants that had the big windows, you know, you could sort of check it out before you went in.
See if it was safe.
Right? Yeah.
Well, actually, when it first came in first appeared in New York in 1912, mm-hmm. Philadelphia in 1902, there were very few places women could go unaccompanied.
Right.
It was
they just wouldn't even have thought of it.
It was kind of taboo in a way, too.
You know,
they didn't have the ice cream parlors. There were a few left, you know, but not a lot of places for women to go. And,
exactly.
And women, you know, there were working women, believe it or not.
Yeah.
I had read that those dolphin heads came from, I think they were replicas of something found in Pompeii.
It was a pump. I knew it was Italy, so I wasn't sure.
I think I read that someplace. But I thought, why? How in the world did that happen?
Yeah,
go figure, right? And it really was not unlike cafeterias. And didn't they have a hot buffet table at one time?
It evolved. They did eventually have restaurants that were more cafeterias, and you could get waitress service. You could sit at a counter. So some of them had also the automat windows, and some of them were just cafeterias. And they sort of evolved, and eventually they had a Burger King franchise in New York City as they sort of converted the real estate, which was, as you could imagine, incredibly valuable, from automats into something considered more modern.
So they kind of died by the 1990s. Well, in inflation, I mean, you know, had to have a lot of nickels, and they had to convert the doors to quarters by then. I mean, that was a problem when the cup of coffee started costing 10 cents.
Yeah, it was a huge controversy when the price of coffee went up, which I think was in the 50s or when it first.
Well, it's you know, sadly, they left us, and the last one closed in 91, but they do remain. They remain. A wonderful exhibit was at the New York Public Library on lunch. That Laura Shapiro did a lot of research on the automat.
Such a beautiful job.
Lunch then. And,
yeah.
And they have been, they are actually sort of a relic of Americana. And there is an automat in the Smithsonian Institute. And very soon, we're going to have another way to remember these automats.
Yes, I
Automat,
hope so.
The movie, coming up after we take a short break.
Listening to Spreading Honey by the California Honey Drops. And this is A Taste of the Past.
You better do what you want when you get up in the morning, cause it won't be long before you're dead and gone.
Yeah,
no, there ain't no telling. Yeah, we all just bet, just playing our hands till the last stand. So tell your mama you've been.
Today's program is brought to you by Buyrite, a family-owned San Francisco-grown market. For more information, visit buyrightmarket.com. Buyrite is a family-owned and San Francisco-grown market that is passionate about creating community through food. From organic farm, direct local produce, sustainably raised meats, and artisan cheeses, to food-friendly wines, house-made foods, and dinners, Buyrite is an essential San Francisco destination for any food lover or cook. And no trip is complete without a visit to the renowned Buyrite Creamery and Bake Shop for a scoop of salted caramel ice cream. Now celebrating 75 years in the Mission District of San Francisco, visit buyrightmarket.com to learn more. Buyrite is a proud business member of Heritage Radio Network, supporting good food media from coast to coast.
Well, we have had the automat history, the automat book, and now we are hopefully soon to have the automat movie. Lisa Hurwitz, who is a director and producer of the automat coming movie, she has a background in arts administration. And this movie is a project that is kind of still in the works, and there is, in fact, a Kickstarter program to help support it. And Lisa is joining us from the West Coast by phone. Lisa, are you there?
I am here, Linda. Thank you so much for having me and for doing an episode on automat.
Well, welcome to this show. I'm very excited for this movie, and there is a teaser on that Kickstarter page, a teaser of the trailer, and it's a documentary, right?
It is. It is a documentary about the life of Hornin Hardart, which is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most fascinating restaurant companies that we've seen in America, and perhaps the most important one that New York or Philadelphia in particular have ever seen.
Interesting. The automat, as I had mentioned earlier before the break, has been memorialized in as a backdrop in many other movies, Hollywood sets, and even in the theater. What inspired you to embark upon this project of making a documentary about it?
Well, you mentioned earlier how the automat was a star of these films, which I appreciated, because the automat, for me, it just has so much personality and character, and it's for someone like myself who never actually experienced it firsthand, when I learned about the automat, I was extremely fascinated by the concept of it. I first came across Hornin Hardart and the automat in an academic journal, actually. I really enjoyed the experience of eating in a cafeteria in college. There was a social element to it that I hadn't really experienced before, and eating together with other people and meeting new people and having discussions, it was just something that meant a lot to me. And so I began researching the history of the cafeteria in America. And I decided, after visiting the Robert F. Burns collection at the New York Public Library, which is the Hornin Hardart collection, after I saw how immaculately the company had preserved its history and what an abundance of material, or visual material, that there was, that I absolutely needed to make this film. And frankly, I was surprised that someone hadn't already done it, because horn and hard art is really such an important part of New York.
Indeed.
And its story. And it's beloved, as you mentioned before. It is a beloved institution, which is very rare for people to feel towards a corporation.
Right.
That's what it was. You know, it was a money-making corporation, but it had a really large positive impact on, you know, the people of the city.
Right, and I really like how you brought up the communal spirit of eating, and how cafeterias do that, how we've brought back in many restaurants today the communal tables, whether you actually turn and talk to your neighbor or not. I mean, there is that feeling of communal activity and conviviality. You also, there's somebody else involved in the production of this documentary, and I feel perhaps we should mention him as well. You said you did a lot of research, and it's Alec Schuldiner. Is it Schuldiner? How do you say his
Schuldiner.
Name? Schuldiner. Okay.
Schuldiner. And Alec authored a PhD dissertation while he was at Cornell in 2001 called Trapped Behind the Automat. And the dissertation is a bit of a comparative analysis between three large restaurant corporations that really have utilized technology as a part of the service that they provide. And so it's Horn and Hardart, White Castle, and then a company in the Netherlands that still provides automat machines to this day called Phoebo. And Alec's dissertation really has been the foundation of everybody's writing about Horn and Hardart. He really was the first person to put the history together, and it's allowed, you know, it helped Marianne write her book, it's helping me write my movie, and so I'm just really grateful. I think we're all grateful that Alec has provided this for us, and it really is a service.
Right. I mean, he talks about technological systems and their use in American restaurants. And it's funny because, as Marianne said, there was really nothing, it's called an automat, but there's really nothing automatic about it, but the technology was so unique, putting a coin in and turn that allowed the knob to turn and open the door. Automat, actually, I think automatos is a German word that means, you know, self-propelling or self, you know, using. So this, indeed, this was such an innovation in American restaurants, in any restaurants for that matter. What, is there a compelling point or a particular view that you are trying to convey in this documentary?
Well, for me, it really comes down to something that you mentioned in your intro about the automat being the great equalizer. And I think that's extremely important and relevant today. You know, there's a lot of topics and themes that come up in the film that are relevant today. We talk about labor and restaurant workers who back in the 1920s were fighting for living wages and better working conditions, and the same thing is happening today. We talk about women who are still fighting today for equal rights in the workplace, the widening gap between the rich and the poor. But for me, the fact that there used to be this place that was good enough for everybody to go to, and it was, they provided the finest, and it was good enough for the rich or the poor, and they could sit next to each other and have a conversation, I think that's something that we really ought to think about. And we ought to, I'm not saying necessarily bring back the automat, but we really can, food really brings people together. And so I think that the fast food that has replaced the automat, I don't know that it necessarily is the best solution, and I think we still have a ways to go.
Right.
And, culturally, yeah.
And hearing from Marianne about the commissaries, I mean, it seems like such a sensible, doable way to, you know, to provide food to a lot of different places, which they do at delis and little bodegas that have, you know, the salad bars. They do have a central commissary that supplies, you know, decent food to them. But, you know, you mentioned the budgetary importance to the working class. And it's interesting because I don't know whether it's the book or somebody in maybe doing the program at the Smithsonian or something did interviews with a lot of people. And one of them was Dick Clark. We all remember Dick Clark when he was young. he first moved to Philadelphia, he said he lived at the Automat. They had the greatest chocolate milk. And he said when he moved to Philadelphia, he apportioned less than $2 a day to eat on. And the Automat was the only place that he could do that. So it's interesting that, this was, you know, you could have a fixed budget. And you knew, because you knew what, you know, how many nickels you had to put in that machine. You knew exactly what you were going to spend. And that was one way that people could really budget their, money.
And you didn't have to tip anybody, so that made it also really clear that you...
That's right. And the in the documentary, are you going to... Is there going to be any mention, do you plan, on the commissaries? Do you cover that at all?
Absolutely. The commissary was one of Horn and Hardart's many important contributions to the American restaurant industry. It really pioneered this system in which you prepare large quantities of food in one place. And of course, Horn and Hardart did it differently because the network that it was extending to was much smaller. You know, there was, as Marianne mentioned, there was a commissary in New York and one in Philadelphia, and they were able to bring the food several times a day to the Automat, and it was fresh. It was not frozen. So today, food has to travel further distances, especially with large fast food chains, so it's not as fresh. But the commissary was a way for Horn and Hardart to provide, one of the ways they were able to provide food cheaply. So that helped keep down the cost for the customer as well, and that was one of the most important parts about the Automat. Marianne mentions in her interview that she did for the film that everyone can afford it, and that was one of the reasons that people remember it with such reverence today. It was something that it was something very fine that everyone could have.
Right, and to me, I just still get that image of, you know, a little kid with big eyes and seeing this wall full of food, and under these, you know, shiny glass and brass boxes, and just, you know, being able to, you know, to go in and choose it, whatever you wanted. That was really a treat. Now, here's the thing: you had to have nickels. So how did one go about getting those nickels, and who were the nickel throwers? Okay, ladies, who wants to answer? Lisa?
Well, the nickel throwers, the way that we kind of fondly remember them are women, but I know for a fact that men were nickel throwers as well, because Norris Horn, who's the great nephew of the founder, he tells a story about how for a day he had to, he was being trained in a lot of different aspects of the company when he was in college, and one of them was being a nickel thrower. And, you know, by the end of the day, you can feel you can feel 20 nickels in your hand, and you know exactly how many it is. So, but anyways, the nickel throwers were the employees of the Automat that sat behind kiosks, and they converted the customer's quarters and later dollars into nickels so that you could put the food into the slots. And the nickel throwers were, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most neat characters at the Automat.
Hmm. Interesting. There's so many interesting, wonderful aspects of the Automat. And what I want to do is remind people that they can... I think the book is still in publication, your book, right?
You can find it, I think, on Amazon. It's hard to find.
The book is called The Automat. That's pretty easy. And
but it's also available as a Kickstarter reward for...
That's the most hard part.
And that was the next thing I wanted to do is Lisa, could you give the listeners the web address for the Kickstarter page?
Absolutely. The Kickstarter, which is running until March 15th, is automatmovie.com. And Marianne's book, The Automat, has been one of our most popular backer rewards. So we're really grateful for the opportunity to be offering that as a reward.
Well, it is such a fantastic project, and I, for one, am really hoping that, you know, you reach your goal and that we can get this movie off the ground, because I can't wait to see all the wonderful interviews and images and certainly, oh, I know what I want to ask right at the end. What, Lisa, and I know, Marianne, you can remember a few, what are some of the more famous movies and I imagine they're from the 30s and 40s, or that had images of the automat in them. Now, Marianne, you had mentioned
That Touch of Mink.
That Touch of Mink, right? Lisa, any come to mind?
Well, my favorite is probably Easy Living with it's the same story in many of these films where you have like a young female coming into the automat kind of down, and then her situation turns around because something happens. She meets someone at the automat.
Right.
So that's probably my favorite one.
Well, hopefully soon we're going to have Automat the documentary. Thank you both for joining me. This is such a wonderful, as I said in the beginning, such a wonderful slice of Americana, a slice of culinary history. And it is indeed the great equalizer, the Automat. Thank you so much for joining me on A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.